Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. This time, Israel continues to step on international law. This time, the regime in Tel Aviv has launched 24 missiles against Syria, and it did this from Lebanon. So not only has it ignored Lebanese sovereignty, but it has launched attacks against Syria. There should be outrage in the international community with these blatant attacks on international law. But remember, the culprit is Israel. So many countries simply look the other way. We're going to start it off by crossing over to Damascus and talking to Mohammed Ali. Mohammed Ali, good to see you. Well, tell us, inform us about this latest situation, what took place.
Yes, what happened was that on Thursday, Israel attacked Syria from Lebanese airspace. Israeli fighter jets carried out the attack, firing a large number of missiles from southeast Lebanon, according to the military in Syria, an official military source. Of course, those missiles targeted areas around Damascus and areas around the city of Homs. After that, the foreign ministry here sent letters to the United Nations Security Council and Secretary General, calling on the international body to shoulder its responsibility in preserving international peace and security, take measures to prevent future Israeli attacks, and also hold Israel accountable for what it described as as Israel's terrorism and crimes. The foreign ministry made it clear, similar to other, of course, letters sent on similar occasions, Israeli airstrikes, made it clear that those Israeli airstrikes are aimed at actually boosting the morale of the remaining terrorist groups inside Syria. The foreign ministry asserted and stressed that such Israeli attacks will not block or hinder the Syrian army from carrying out its mission in defeating the remaining terrorist groups in Syria, mainly Daesh and the al-Nusra Front. And finally, very important point, which is that after 24 hours of this attack, the Russian Ministry of Defense announced some details saying that the Russian-made Syrian air defenses were able to shoot down 22 out of 24 Israeli missiles, and that the two that were knocked down did not actually kill any Syrian military personnel or cause any damage to the infrastructure. This is the second time that Russia announces details about Syria's downing of Israeli missiles, in what is seen over here by analysts as an indirect message from Russia that it will not allow Israel to cause any more damage in its attacks on Syria.
All right. Thank you so much for that update. That's Mohammed Ali out of Damascus. Now I'd like to introduce my guests to the spotlight. Out of New York, author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh. And out of Halstead, historian and journalist Fred Younger.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Thanks so much for being with us. Let's start this off in New York with Jim. What do you see as the main reason, the main goal that these attacks continue by Israel? I mean, what's their goal at this point in time?
Well, your correspondent said something which I think is true, which is that Israel, along with the United States, wants to maintain the regime change war in Syria. And they have not given up on that, and they want to weaken the Syrian government as much as possible. They'd like to turn Syria into a failed state, as they did with Libya. So Israel is going to constantly be attacking Syria, and they're going to be, now they always claim they're attacking Hezbollah formations in Syria and Hezbollah facilities, and of course Hezbollah is also a target of theirs that they really don't like to have around because Hezbollah is becoming too strong. So Hezbollah, the Israelis are, have been, you know, for decades destroying the strong resistant states around them, turning them into fell states and jihadi havens. That's what they tried to do with Syria. They've failed so far because of the Russian help and the Russian intervention. And but you've got to see, they have not given up, and the Americans have not given up. American troops are still occupying one-third of Syria, including its oil reserves and its best wheat-producing regions. And as, you know, for all the Americans' complaints about what kind of whether the Taliban are going to give refuge to al-Qaeda, it was an American administration official a couple of years ago who said the largest safe haven for al-Qaeda in the world is in Idlib. And that's the case. The Americans were protecting al-Qaeda and al-Nusra and the remnants of al-Qaeda. So, but this is part of the plan to destroy certainly the secular nationalist states and all states that are resisting Israeli aggression. And that Israel wants to have and will be given as much as possible by the United States impunity to attack any country around it in any way it sees fit.
Well, Brett, how do you see it? I mean, when we look at the situation, 22 of the 24 missiles that Israel fired were intercepted by anti-missile aircraft with the anti-missile fire with from the Syrian military. And as our analysts, our correspondent said earlier, that actually Russia has made a point of announcing this. So the Israelis know what's going on. Your perspective about why you think Russia is rushing to announce this situation, and does it show that there is a change in Russia's strategy in dealing with Israel in the situation of Syria?
Well, I should certainly hope so, indeed. That it is an encouraging fact that that twice already now Russia has come out with the news, confirming, of course, reports that came from Syria, knowing, of course, full well that Russia in the international community has somewhat of a bigger pull and a bigger credibility, unfortunately, of course, because the powers that be generally don't listen to countries like Syria. But when Russia speaks up, there is a more, it is a larger gravitas, of course, to these claims, and that now we can be quite certain, indeed, that 22 out of the 24 missiles that were fired by Israeli aircraft, incidentally fired from within Lebanese airspace, apparently, were indeed downed and were completely unsuccessful in reaching any strategic or crucial infrastructure or kill anyone in Syria at all. This is a major victory in and of itself, of course, of the development of the resistance in the Middle East in general. And the fact that Russia announced this could be, of course, I remain carefully optimistic in this regard, could herald a more active role of Russia in actively calling out the powers of the West and the Zionists in the region. Of course, we always have to bear in mind that Russia did a lot of work in helping the Syrian Arab Republic in repelling the Daesh terrorists and al-Qaeda and other groups that were backed by the West and they were sent to destroy Syria. The Russian aid in this regard has been of crucial importance, of course. But so far, Russia has kind of neglected for a long part, the past couple of years, to call out the powers that are really behind all of this actively. Most importantly, in this regard, being Israel. Israel has been carrying out airstrikes against Syria for years without declaring war, without any official state of conflict existing between the Zionist entity and Syria. But we have very often, even though this has risked Russian lives, we have very rarely seen an official Russian call-out and Russian condemnation of what is going on here. Of course, because Russia, at the same time, tries to, let's say, play both sides. They have this realpolitik going on, which, of course, they don't want to antagonize the Western powers too much. And antagonizing Israel means antagonizing the Western powers to the west of the Russian borders. But, of course, at one point, enough is enough. And this is an interesting concept we have seen right now. And I think this has to do with the fact that Israel has gotten more brazen. They have gotten way more aggressive in the past couple of months, especially with Israeli Zionist leaders trying to show off their like quote-unquote bravery and their militancy, and that way trying to take away attention from the massive economic and political turmoil that has existed in Israel over the past couple of months. And I think this has led Russia to side more obviously with the resistance front that exists in Western Asia, in this case particularly Syria, in calling out these attacks as they happened. Aside from that, the fact that these attacks were shot down, 22 out of 24 were successfully intercepted, means that what has been going on for a while already is confirmed, being that the air superiority, the undisputed air superiority that the Zionists had in the region for decades, is coming to an end. We have modern equipment coming into Syria from Iran, from Russia, and from other backers of the resistance. And we have gotten an increased capability and strength in terms of defensive measurements, both in missile defense and in missile attack as well, in front of resistance powers in the region. We're talking particularly Hezbollah and the Syrian Arab Republic. They have shown time and time again, especially now, the capacity to push back against what was considered at one point, of course, the most advanced air force in the entire Middle East.
All right. What do you think about that, Jim? Because the once, as the Israelis like to call themselves at one point in time, being invincible, obviously that was never the case, but it's even showing itself more and more now as there's a little bit more equity, even with this anti-missile system that the Syrians have used. How is that affecting the Israeli mentality in general? As Brett had said, we're seeing them being more and more arrogant these days. But overall, how do you assess the situation?
Yeah, I want to be careful about this. I think it is definitely true that the Syrian state, and with the help of the Russian intervention, has more capability to defend itself from Israeli air power. Israeli air power is still dominant. There's nothing like it in the region, okay? Mm-hmm. But Russian air defenses are very, very good. Now, I think they've given the Syrians S-400s, which is a very good air defense system. But the S-500 would be even better. But they have been restrained in their allowance of letting the Syrians use that to the fullest extent, okay? They're not going to give them the S-500. And they don't want to, for example, they probably could. They don't want to shoot down those Israeli airplanes that are hanging back over Lebanon and firing missiles into Syria, okay? They're going to let those, they've let those Israeli airplanes go. And they're saying, they did say in July and last night that the Russians helped the Syrians use these systems in a way that was more effective. So you've got this very little dangerous game going on. The Israelis are more aggressive. They want to push more aggressively. They don't want to let things keep developing in a way that's going to progressively weaken them. On the other hand, the Russians want to control the level at which things escalate. So they don't want to see direct attacks on Israeli planes. This is a very tricky little situation. So that's, I think, you know, we have to see how that's going to develop. It's unclear. The Israelis are going to get more aggressive, especially since what happened in Afghanistan. They know that the political pressure in the United States now, what they're going to use is the fact that there's political pressure in the United States now that the U.S. should never back down. And they're going to have to, Biden is going to have to feel he has to make up for his loss in Afghanistan by showing how strong he is in other places and by never backing down on his support of Israel. Should the Syrian Arab army, the Syrian army using his Russian missiles, shoot down an Israeli plane over Lebanese airspace, even one that's attacking them, it would be legitimate for them to do that, but it would be a big escalation, and everybody knows it. So it's a little tricky. The United States is never going to accept anything that is a direct threat to Israel, and everybody is aware of that and has to be aware of that. And the Russians are playing very carefully, have been and still are playing very carefully with that.
Well, Jim, what do you think it would take? Brett, sorry. What do you think it's going to take? Jim was talking about that the Russians are playing very carefully. But if this situation continues to escalate, and according to both of you, your analysis is that it definitely will. The Israelis are going to get more aggressive. I mean, somewhere down the line, either it's going to happen, as he said, maybe the Syrians will end up shooting down an Israeli plane, or it may force the hands of the Russians to get a little bit more involved. I mean, what do you think it will take for Russia to cross that line and basically say enough is enough, especially after they also has, they have invested in the defense of the Syrian people?
Yeah, I'm afraid that at the rate in which things are going now, it is quite possible that Russia will only be able to be pulled over the hedge, let's say, in consistently defending Syria, only after, at a certain point, an Israeli attack would end up killing Russian servicemen. Because, of course, there are a multitude of Russian allies who are either in military means or in technical support or in intelligence, who are in Syria helping the Syrians, coordinating the war against terrorist militias and groups in regions such as Idlib. And there is going to be the constant threat, of course. Every single one of these attacks against Syria risks, in the end, also affecting Russian servicemen. So I could see an escalation coming in that regard once a Russian were to die in one of these Israeli attacks. Unfortunately, this is an unfortunate fact in a way, because in a completely just world, let's say, in which the gears of society and the gears of world politics were to grind more fairly, then the world would agree that Russia and Syria are already well within the right to shoot down these Israeli planes as soon as they start firing missiles against Syria, or as soon as they violate Lebanese airspace with aggressive intentions against Syria. But unfortunately, you have this sort of what they call a 3D chess game going on in Moscow, in which they are trying to weigh off all the options. But from the Syrian point of view, of course, this Russian carefulness doesn't exactly help Syria very much, because these attacks keep on happening and happening. And as indeed has been said by the other guests, the Israelis are more likely than not to get even more aggressive and more bloodthirsty as the time goes on, because Israel at this point in time is in some ways kind of a wounded animal. It's not dying yet, not immediately, but it has gotten several beatings over the past couple of years. And we know this because even the former chief of the Internal Intelligence and Security Service, the Shin Bet in Israel, has a couple of years ago has said that, in his opinion, the way things are going now, Israel will not survive the coming generation, even if it's just because of demographic issues in which the Israelis are facing, which I can't get into right now. But this means that Israel is facing a very existential threat. Zionism as a concept, as an entity, is facing an existential crisis, and they know this. And the only way that they know of to solve a problem like this is by going somewhere and killing some more people, by hopefully that way beating the war and getting the fires of patriotism further going. So when this keeps on going, it's only a matter of time before attacks against Russia, against Syria escalate. And unfortunately, in time, this might involve the loss of life on the Russian side as well.
Jim, your take. I mean, how dangerous is this whole thing for the international community, international law? I mean, we continue to see basically Israel ignore or crush, actually, international law. I mean, this is not just dangerous for the countries in the region, but in general, when you have an entity, a rabid entity that is out of control.
Yeah, I mean, Israel is above the law. I mean, it's been given impunity by the United States, which, you know, extends into the United Nations Security Council, of course. And, you know, everybody kind of sits back and accepts it, and because of the power that's behind it. And it's this black letter international law that they're violating at will every day or every week or whatever they want to. Okay, they're violating international law, and they're violating even the terms of their agreement on the Lebanese ceasefire. And it's extremely dangerous. Look, the Israelis have already killed Russians. They shadowed a Russian plane plane a year or so ago, a couple of years ago. That's what their jets do. They shadowed a Russian military craft, which was shot down by mistake by the Syrians. They shadowed a conventional airliner, a civilian airliner. Last night they had this. There were four civilian airliners that had to get out of the way. So that's what they do over Lebanese airspace. They play that little game, and you know everybody knows that if an Israeli airplane is shot down, Israelis are going to respond with massive force on Syria. The Americans will support them. This is a very dangerous, dangerous game. Israel wants to get a general war, which will end up being a war against Iran. That's what their objective has been for at least a decade. And it's becoming kind of more, they're becoming more desperate to get that to happen, even though they're becoming weaker every day in the possibility of what's going to happen to them if that happens. So, but it is a very dangerous game. Everybody should be aware of this. We kind of blithely go along. You know, what's Lebanon? What is that? Nobody in the United States knows. This is what's happening in Lebanon is a disaster. And it's part of this game. And Syria, you know, we still occupy a third of Syria. What are we doing there? Nobody in America can think about what the reason for that might be. And we still maintain and protect the last redoubt of the biggest redoubt of Al-Qaeda and its jihadi affiliates in Syria. And nobody even thinks about it until some kind of explosion happens. So this is the situation we're in. It's extremely dangerous, extremely dangerous.
Brett, what do you think has to happen? I mean, how can this be balanced out? We've been talking about the increased aggression of the Israeli regime. So, and we have seen a lack of interest or response by the so-called international community. So what's the key here? How can countries such as Syria get some type of political equity in this world? What needs to happen?
Well, I'm afraid that we are well beyond the possibility in that regard of negotiated solutions, especially when it comes to the Zionist entity. That has been basically that chance has been gone for several decades already. At the very least, since the last possible moment that could happen was probably in 1967, before the complete occupation of Palestinian lands of every part of Palestinian land by the Zionists. So the only real option there is right now is the option of resistance. This is also the only option that has kept Israel from completely demolishing the Al-Aqsa compound a couple of months ago in the conflict around Palestine. This has prevented Israel from crossing back into Gaza and recolonizing the area, because people in Gaza resist, people in the West Bank resist, people, Palestinians living within the 1948 border of quote-unquote Israel, they started resisting and rising up and fighting back. And this is the only thing that has helped. Israel has lost humiliating defeats, especially in the past couple of decades, and it was always at the hand of an organized and armed resistance. Most importantly, of course, Lebanon in the year 2000 and in the year 2006, when Israel was driven out twice in the span of that one decade.
30 seconds,
so,
Brett.
This is a need for a resistance that primarily has to come from the Arab and Islamic countries of the region, in which, as has been said before, the Russians, they have a certain role to play, but they are not the most immediate trustworthy allies. It has to be the people on the ground, the Palestinians and their Arab and Muslim and Christian allies in that area, that have to band together and fight against the Zionist entity and their imperialist goals.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us on this spotlight. Author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York, and historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
Oh, Hussein, Imam Hussein. Oh, Hussein, Imam Hussein. Ya Mawla, Mawla, Ya Mawla, Mawla, Ya Mawla, Mawla, Ya Mawla. Oh, Hussein, Imam Hussein.
I was sitting in my room with a thought on my mind, that how grateful we are to have you, oh Hussein.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
And I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah. I thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we are trying to talk about the different verses of the Holy Quran, which are thematically connected to our topic, which is Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So stay with us, and let's listen to some of the verses.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. And abide in your houses, and do not display yourselves as was the display of the former times of ignorance. And establish prayer, and give zakah, and obey Allah and His Messenger. Allah intends only to remove from you the impurity of sin, O people of the Prophet's household, and to purify you with extensive purification.
We were discussing the successorship of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam on the earth, and actually their vicegerency that has been reflected in the narrations. The Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam are truly the chosen ones, and they are the manifestations of Almighty Allah's attributes. They are endowed with the features of the prophets. Except the prophethood, but they have the features of morality and faith of the Holy Prophet in a way that even their enemies admit. Even the fair-minded Sunni scholars have referred to it by reporting that Holy Prophet has said, "من أراد أن ينظر إلى آدم في علمه وإلى يحيى بن زكريا في زهده وإلى موسى بن عمران في بطشه فلينظر إلى علي بن أبي طالب." One who wishes to look at Adam's knowledge, Noah's understanding, and John's piety and Moses' firm acts, he should look at Ali ibn Abi Talib. Anyway, the vicegerents and imams after the Holy Prophet are 12 in number. They all have been appointed by Almighty Allah to have authority over people. Of course, some pseudo-scholars following the Umayyad school think that these position and features are found in families other than that of the Holy Prophet, and that's why they ignored Almighty Allah's choosing the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, and they somehow resorted to their own choice, even though the Holy Quran says, وَرَبُّكَ يَخْلُقُ مَا يَشَاءُ وَيَخْتَارُ مَا كَانَ لَهُمُ الْخِيَارَةُ سُبْحَانَ اللَّهِ وَتَعَالَى عَمَّا يُشْرِكُونَ. And your Lord creates and chooses whom He pleases. To choose is not theirs, glory be to Allah, and exalted be He above what they associate with Him. And this was the beginning of the deviation that was the origination of the martyrdom of Imam Husayn alayhi salam. This is what led to the happenings of Karbala.
O people, compete with each other in attaining noble traits, and hasten to acquire lofty benefits, and do not count those good deeds which you have delayed.
The Holy Quran says, وَمَا كَانَ لِمُؤْمِنٍ وَلَا مُؤْمِنَةٍ إِذَا قَضَى اللَّهُ وَرَسُولُهُ أَمْرًا أَنْ يَكُونَ لَهُمُ الْخِيَرَةُ مِنْ أَمْرِهِمْ. And it behooves not a believing man and woman that they should have any choice in their matter when Allah and His Apostle have decided a matter. مَا لَكُمْ كَيْفَ تَحْكُمُونَ. What happened to you? How do you judge? The Holy Quran says elsewhere. Interestingly, in this regard, Imam Ridha alayhi salam resorts to the Holy Quran and says, ذَلِكَ فَضْلُ اللَّهِ يُؤْتِهِ مَنْ يَشَاءُ. This is the grace of Allah, and He gives it to whom He pleases. This means that Imam Ridha alayhi salam is trying to prove the right of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and he is trying to denounce those who have been chosen by others as the leaders. And they are the ones who have prepared the way for division among the Muslim nation. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam says, Muhammad's descendants are the best descendants. That is why we have so many narrations from the Holy Prophet ﷺ introducing the Ahlul Bayt to us by saying, وَعَلِي يُبْنُ أَبِي طَالِبٍ أَخِي وَمِنِّي وَأَنَا مِنْ عَلِي. Ali bin Abi Talib is from me and I am from him. فَهُوَ بَابُ عِلْمِي وَوَصِيِّ. He is the gate of my knowledge. He is my successor. وَهُوَ وَفَاطِمَ وَالْحَسَنُ وَالْحُسَيْنُ هُمْ خَيْرُ الْأَرْضِ عُنْصُرًا وَشَرَفًا وَكَرَمًا. And Ali, Fatima, Hassan and Hussein are the best on the earth in terms of honor and dignity. So this is one of the reasons we have so many narrations introducing the Ahlul Bayt to us, introducing them as the true vicegerents on the earth and the true successors of the Prophet ﷺ. They are the true meaning of Siratul Mustaqim. They are the straight path. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
دمعت عليك ظلت تنزل جروح يا ابو اليمة بمصابك ذابت الروح طلب راي توفقني بخدمتك ولا تحرمني من الدمع والنور يا ابو النعمة وباب للرحمة أدري توفيقي هو أسبابه إلك أسأل وانت تتفضل من توظفني خادم ببابه
يا سيدي أسألك الدعاء يا سيدي أسألك الدعاء
يا وجيها
سيدي أسألك الدعاء يا سيدي
اشفع لنا
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
The
UK government came under immense fire today after MPs condemned the catastrophic British failures in Afghanistan. During Wednesday's parliamentary debate on the subject, Boris Johnson desperately attempted to convince MPs that Britain's withdrawal wasn't chaotic at all, but with little success.
Mr. Speaker, I think it would be fair to say that the events in Afghanistan have unfolded and the collapse has been faster than I think even the Taliban themselves predicted. What is not true is to say that the UK government was unprepared or did not foresee this.
Before the debate even started, anti-war Labour MPs gathered outside Westminster with anti-war veteran Jeremy Corbyn to denounce British foreign policy.
Many of the MPs who have been supportive of the continued war and occupation in Afghanistan will be sitting today during this debate, which has already begun. Now, this will be very awkward for them, as many of the anti-war MPs who have criticised British foreign policy, particularly in Afghanistan for many, many years, have been proven right following the latest developments in Afghanistan.
British military failures was not the only focus of criticism. Concern over the lack of willingness to help Afghan refugees was expressed too. For the time being, the UK is refusing to recognise the Taliban's administration, but have agreed to accept some refugees, but only time will tell if Britain will honour this pledge or not. Robert Carter, London.
On the other side of Milak crossing point in east of Iran, the Taliban have taken down the Afghan flag and raised their own white flag, a move that represents their control of Afghan borders. This has given Iranians the jitters that Afghanistan's insecurity might spill into Iran. Since the conflict erupted in Afghanistan, Iran's border police have deployed more forces to its eastern borders to beef up security. Iran's border police say they constantly monitor the frontier and are ready to confront any hostile action along the border.
As you see, security is fully ensured here on our borders, and transit between the two countries is ongoing. Any suspicious movement along the border is monitored and will be nipped in the bud by our armed forces.
Over the past days, Iran's eastern border has been buzzing with Afghan refugees who are escaping from an uncertain future under the Taliban, who have now taken full control of the country after the central government collapsed. The majority of the fleeing Afghans have climbed a 50-kilometer concrete wall topped with barbed wire Iran erected more than a decade ago to block drug smuggling.
We embraced all the hardship and dangers to get to Iran. We walked for 4 days to get here.
I urge Iranian officials to let us stay here. In our country, there's no hope for peace and security. Otherwise, I wouldn't have left my homeland.
Iran's border police say they will peacefully return refugees who have made irregular crossings. Meanwhile, Iran has set up makeshift camps along the border to temporarily accommodate the inbound refugees.
Based on religious teaching, we feel bound to serve our Afghan brothers and sisters who have sought refuge in our country. The Iranian armed forces accommodated them and provided them with food and medicine, and we hope they will find peace when they go back to their homeland.
Turkey has been building a 240-kilometer wall along its frontier with Iran to push back the fleeing Afghans. Last week, Pakistan has clashed with Afghan refugees at its border to hold them out, while Iran says it has been acting as a shield that limits the flow of Afghan migrants toward Turkey and Europe. It believes the situation cannot be solved with force, and collective measures need to be taken by world leaders to avert a refugee crisis.
Well, on the other side of this bridge, the conflict almost subsided. The influx of Afghan refugees still goes on. Iran's border police say they will continue to shelter Afghan refugees, hoping that Afghanistan will soon be a safe place for its people. Yusuf Jalali from Milak crossing point on the Iranian-Afghan border.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and German Chancellor Angela Merkel held talks in the Kremlin. This is their last summit meeting as heads of state because Merkel will not participate in the upcoming parliamentary elections in Germany. Her farewell visit took place on the anniversary of the alleged poisoning of opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
Despite the fact that we have different opinions, I think it is good that we talk to each other and we intend to keep in touch further.
After the meeting with the Russian President, Merkel called on Putin to release Navalny. Putin, however, said the fight against corruption should not be used as an instrument of political struggle, adding the opposition figure was convicted not for his political activities, but for criminal offenses against foreign partners. The two also touched upon the situation in Afghanistan. Putin said Moscow's priority is to prevent terrorists from entering neighboring countries under the guise of refugees.
We know Afghanistan, and we know how this country is organized and how counterproductive it is to try to impose unusual forms of government and public life on it. Any such socio-political experiments have never been successful and led only to the destruction of states, degradation of their political and social systems.
In addition to bilateral relations, the fight against the coronavirus pandemic, the conflict in eastern Ukraine, the situation in Belarus, as well as Nord Stream 2 and the role of Ukraine as a transit country for Russian gas were discussed.
Merkel managed to defend the Nord Stream. The Americans pressed on her. Germany needs Russian energy. Regarding the situation in Afghanistan, here Germany fully listened to what the Americans were saying, and now Germany has received it in full. The Americans are living in an ugly way, having substituted all their allies in the NATO alliance. This once again showed that Germans that it's absurd to rely on the US. America's visit shows that the stake on in America is doubtless wrong, and Germany during the reign of Merkel has repeatedly succumbed to influence from overseas.
On August 22nd, Merkel will fly to Kyiv. Putin asked her to influence the country's authorities to fulfill all obligations on Donbas. Berlin has always been one of Moscow's main partners in politics and economics. The Russian president expressed hope that with the new leadership in Germany, in the near future, it would be possible to continue the dialogue on resolving the conflict in southeastern Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Turkey says it will decide on Taliban's government recognition after it is formed. Turkish foreign minister said Ankara will not rush into recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan as it is still too early for this step.
We are keeping up dialogue with all sides, including the Taliban. We view positively the messages that the Taliban have given so far, whether to foreigners, diplomatic individuals, or its own people. We hope to see these in action as well.
In response to a question regarding Turkey's contact with the Taliban, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey had invited the political wing of the Taliban to Turkey before they had entered Kabul. Earlier, Turkish security sources said Ankara had dropped plans to guard and operate Kabul's airport after the withdrawal of NATO forces from Afghanistan, following footage and reports of chaos taking place there after Taliban's takeover. Turkey says its offer to provide technical and security assistance at the Kabul airport will be further discussed with the U.S.
Turkey will follow the lead of other countries in recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan. If the U.S. and EU countries recognize a government formed by Taliban, Turkey will follow in their footsteps. However, I don't think that Turkey will consider the Taliban government as a strategic partner in the region. We expect a delegation from the Taliban to visit Turkey for talks over the transition phase, just like it is taking place with other countries in the region.
The Turkish president had announced last week his readiness to meet with the Taliban leadership. Turkey says so far the Taliban is sending positive messages, hoping that it will be followed with positive actions as well. Turkey is now concerned about the refugee influx it is going to have after Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan. This comes as it has been struggling to revive the economic situation in the country with a handful of refugees already there amid the coronavirus pandemic. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, dressed in black, marched along major streets beating their chests in mourning over the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, his household, and his loyal companions in Karbala in present-day Iraq. The army of Yazid conducted the massacre in the most brutal manner.
They have shown merciless acts in that field, in which Imam Hussein and his household, his sahabas, in which they believe in him, and even babies in which they have been born, they have been killed.
Members of the Islamic movement said the Ashura is a time for sorrow and is a time for self-reflection when one commits oneself completely to the mourning of Imam Hussein. They said commemorating the martyrdom in Karbala signifies the ultimate prize in the pursuit of justice and righteousness.
The Ashura teaching, it teaches us to be honest in all our believing, to commit all our faith to Almighty Allah. We should not fear any creator in this earth if we want to fulfill our promise to be a good Muslim or to practice the religion of our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his descendants the way it is.
According to the Islamic movement, the Ashura processions were conducted peacefully in many Nigerian cities. However, they said two people were killed in the northwestern Nigerian state of Sokoto, where the Nigeria police attacked the procession with live rounds. Danjum Abdullahi, Suleja.
The 10th day of Muharram has been a day of mourning and commemoration of the martyrdom of the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, Hussein ibn Ali, also in Italy. Faithfuls from across the Italian peninsula met at Rome's Imam Mahdi Islamic Center to honor the Battle of Karbala and remember the sacrifices of the Imam Hussein, whose death is considered a symbol of the struggle against tyranny and injustice.
I have goosebumps when Ashura comes, and I move to tears when I listen to Imam Hussein's words. I always take my children to the Ashura ceremonies. I want them to understand what Imam Hussein did for us.
Ashura is everything to me. Ashura is death, rebirth, life. We have to follow Imam Hussein's example, the way he stood against his enemies, who were nothing but traitors.
The Ashura commemoration at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center has been attended by Shia Muslims coming from a number of countries, including Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, India, and Moldavia.
Many at the Imam Mahdi Center here in Rome believe Ashura is not just a day in history. They are of the idea that Iran's consistency in resisting hegemony is rooted precisely in the culture of Ashura.
Our resistance to hegemonic plans is great thanks to the legacy of Imam Hussein. Active opposition to hegemony is possible through resistance at the level of everyday life. In fact, our faith reflects a model that can serve all societies.
Celebration at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center have included performing tajieh, cooking various kinds of food and distributing it among the attendants, and a final speech by Sheikh Abbas Di Palma, in which he remembered the Battle of Karbala and the attack and the killing of Imam Hussein. Max Civili, Rome.
Video was filmed on Ashura Day in Sayyida Sukaina Shrine in Daraya in Damascus countryside before the war in Syria started. Mourners used to peacefully mark the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. However, the site nowadays is in a totally different situation. Terrorists occupied and used the shrine as a stronghold during the clashes that happened there, gradually causing its destruction.
Terrorists are implementing a global and intelligence plot. They target our symbols and try to destroy them. For example, in Raqqa, they destroyed the shrine of a symbol of Siffin battle, Sayyid Ammar bin Yasser, and in Damascus, Sayyida Sukaina. They want to break the morale of resistance supporters.
Those images are seen by Syrians as an interpretation of what the followers of oppressors and tyrants of our time want for Islam, which are terrorists operating as tools of our time's main oppressor, the United States. In 2016, they left Daraya to Idlib, leaving total destruction behind. But their departure reflected their ultimate defeat. It was resistance by the Syrian army and its allies that led to their victory.
Islamic resistance all around the world raised the flag of righteousness and defeated Takfir terrorism, Israel and the U.S. The resistance in Lebanon and Syria derived its power from Imam Hussein's revolution in Ashura, which created the philosophy of freedom and liberation.
Sayyida Sukaina is the granddaughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the sister of Imam Hussein, who led a historic and peaceful uprising against the tyrant Yazid. He was martyred in 680 AD, along with his companions, while his family members were brutally taken as captives from one city to another. Syria is a country that hosts a large number of holy Islamic sites. Takfiri terrorists' Islamic disguise was eventually unveiled, and the truth was revealed that they are just agents of the West. If it wasn't for the resistance movement and fighters who follow the path of Imam Hussein, probably many other sites, like Sayyida Zainab Shrine, would have been destroyed. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Panicked and distressed, Afghans continue to seek refuge in Iran as they face a dim future in their country. As ex-Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled his country and ceded power to the Taliban, Iran's eastern borders have seen an unabated influx of Afghans who seek a new life in Iran.
This is the Iranian-Afghan border. Afghan refugees have just crossed into Iran, a country they call it a second home.
Some used to be wealthy businessmen who have lost their possessions in the conflict, and others are simply concerned about the future of their children. But all wind up here in this camp, where they have to wait for a decision by Iranian authorities whether to let them in or send them back to their country.
I ask the Iranian government to allow us to stay here until the situation improves in our country. If we were not forced to, we would have not deserted our homeland.
I have nothing to lose. There is no future for me and my children in Afghanistan. I came to Iran as my last hope to build a future for my two kids.
How can I raise my kids in my country? My husband has lost everything. We spent all we have to get to Iran.
Iran's border police have set up makeshift camps alongside the country's eastern border with Afghanistan to temporarily accommodate the inbound refugees. Milak Crossing Point in Sistan and Balochistan is one of the border crossings that has seen the entry of more than 600 Afghans every day since the Taliban began advancing in Afghanistan. The Iranian armed forces say they have received incoming Afghans with open arms, providing them with all the relief items such as masks and disinfectants, food and medicine.
Over the past week, Iran's armed forces have spared no effort to accommodate our Afghan brothers and sisters who have sought refuge in our country. It's our duty first as human beings and then as Muslims who share the same language and culture to offer services to our troubled neighbor.
The collapse of the Afghan army and the government began with U.S. President Joe Biden's implementation of his predecessor's planned troop withdrawal after two decades of presence on the Afghan soil, something which Afghans say has yielded nothing but destruction and bloodshed for their country.
The U.S. invaded our country in 2001 on the pretext of promoting peace and security. But after 20 years, it left us with nothing but misery, poverty, unemployment, and now displacement.
Iran is already home to some 3 million Afghan refugees and economic migrants, the majority of whom are unregistered. Now with a dream for a bright future, these people hope that Iran's border will separate them from their tumultuous past. Yusuf Jalali, from Iran-Afghanistan border.
"24 hours after the first plane carrying Italian nationals and diplomatic staff arrived in Rome from Kabul, top officials from Italy's government expressed their opinions about the Afghan crisis. Prime Minister Mario Draghi stressed the importance of preventing terrorism from spreading and protecting Afghan civilians and those who worked with the international community. Separately, the head of the Foreign Affairs Ministry, Luigi Di Maio, called on Western countries to seriously reflect on the mistakes made during the U.S.-led occupation that went on in the landlocked Central Asian country for 20 years. Analysts and commentators have also been deeply critical of Washington and its allies.
Betrayal, that's all Afghans are left with. All of their expectations have been betrayed. The ethical failure comes even before the political one. After 10 years, the U.S. had finally killed bin Laden in 2011. Why did they stay in Afghanistan? To export democracy? In the interest of whom?
About 50,000 Italian soldiers were deployed to Afghanistan over the past 20 years. making Italy one of the countries most involved in the region, along with the United States, Turkey, Britain, and Germany.
It was on December 30, 2001, when the Italian military arrived in the area entrusted to them by the US, the quadrant of Herat, in the northwest of Afghanistan. The number of Italian soldiers killed since the beginning of the US occupation is 53.
Also, about 700 Italian soldiers have remained seriously or permanently injured. The mistakes made by the U.S. in Afghanistan include handing government posts to sycophants or corrupt figures.
Italians were puzzled after U.S. President Joe Biden's recent statements, in which he admitted that the reason for staying in Afghanistan after Osama bin Laden's killing was not to rebuild the country, but to prevent other terrorist threats from arising there.
I have been very much disappointed by what both Biden and Blinken said about the drawdown. Biden's shift from nation-building to limited counter-terrorist strikes in Afghanistan is very hypocritical. Many of us were there to rebuild a ravaged country. I hope European members will finally work towards creating a European Union military force. It's the only way we can have our say on international issues.
Italy's foreign ministry has said it is now working on a coordinated international initiative in Afghanistan to ensure humanitarian flights and make sure to tackle the emergency in an organized manner. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. A total of 10 prisoners are going on with their protests, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. According to their families, Israel is responsible for the lives of the hunger strikers, as many were transferred to jail's military clinics after their health conditions deteriorated, while refusing to allow even their lawyers to visit them.
We know that Mujahid was transferred to the Ramleh military clinic. This means he's in a bad health condition. He has been detained over 1 year ago under administrative detention, while he was not tried in Israeli court and there are no charges against him. He decided to start an open-ended hunger strike after the Israeli authorities renewed his administrative detention for the third time. It is unfair.
Scores of Palestinians, including prisoners, relatives, and friends, as well as prisoners' advocacy groups, protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, as well as with the sick inmates who face medical negligence by the Israeli Prisons Administration, while the health conditions of many of them have seriously deteriorated.
We are here today to send a message that the prisoners are not alone in their battle. We are their voice outside the jail. We are here to support the hunger-striking prisoners and to support the sick prisoners, as a number of prisoners' lives are in danger. On top of those sick prisoners are Ayad Herabat and Nasser Abu Hamid. We are demanding the Red Cross Committee to immediately act and save them because their health is seriously deteriorating.
Administrative detention is illegal. However, it's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers.
Despite international rejection of administrative detentions, Tel Aviv is pushing with the illegal practice. It continues to trigger more hunger strikes by the Palestinian inmates who say their move is a legitimate means to resist the Israeli policy. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan. La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful.
May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs. Before starting our show, I'd like to offer my condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the third Imam of the Shia school of thought, and the great tragedy of Karbala and his loyal companions. The topic that we are, inshallah, discussing here would be related to somehow to the down